This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berlin. Coming up, the Department of Agriculture proposes rules to define what food is and is not organic. We'll hear what they propose, and next week we'll hear what people think. Gorillas in Uganda are doing okay, but their cousins in Rwanda are threatened by the political situation just like their human counterparts are. Environment Show advisors reflect on the Kyoto Agreement and on politicians who are asking whether growth is always a good idea. On the Earth Calendar, we go to Tasmania, where a serious drought is occurring. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Last December, the U.S. Department of Agriculture published a proposed set of rules which would define what foods can be labeled as organic. These proposals are extremely detailed. Comprising over 100 pages, they cover all aspects of food production, from treatment of soils to medicines that can and cannot be fed to livestock to processing and labeling. Only if all applicable criteria are met will a food be able to be marketed as organic. The department posted the rules on the Internet, and you can read them at www.ams.usda.gov/NOP. At the same website, you can express your own views about the proposals and read what everybody else has been saying. The comment period ends in mid-March. In this two-part series, we will first hear from the Department of Agriculture about what they think they're trying to accomplish. Next, we'll speak to some of the hundreds of people who have filed comments already about the first-ever proposed federal rules covering the definition of organic food. Eileen Stomas is Deputy Administrator of the Transportation and Marketing Programs of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The proposed rule will establish uniform national standards for the production of all raw or processed agricultural products. We're expecting that the rule will do two things. First of all, it'll level the playing field for the producer who now is having to deal with certifications from a number of different organizations, all of which have somewhat different standards. It will also reduce confusion for the consumer who now is not sure what the organic label means on a particular product. I'd also like to say that it will assist our organic producers and processors in the international market, because there will be one consistent national standard which will be a known quantity when they export out of the U.S.
The proposed rules as published would permit foods that have been genetically engineered, irradiated to kill harmful bacteria, or grown in soil that has been treated with sewage sludge to be classified as organic. This has created a storm of controversy, originating with growers that now produce foods certified as organic by various independent national and international organic certification organizations. Again, Deputy Administrator Stomas.
At this point, the proposed rule is asking for public comment specifically on genetically engineered organisms, on irradiation, and on the use of biosolids. I'd like to make a couple of comments about that. The Organic Foods Production Act, which was passed in 1990, which is the basis for the proposed rule, is silent on GEOs. It is also silent on irradiation. We have gotten feedback from the organic industry, and they have been negative. The National Organic Standards Board recommended prohibiting genetically engineered organisms. But in developing the rule, we felt that we wanted to get broad public comment on whether genetically engineered organisms should be prohibited, whether they should be permitted, or whether they should be permitted on a case-by-case basis. So the purpose of the proposed rule is essentially to be neutral and to take comments on each of these materials and their suitability for use in organic production.
Stoma says the proposed organic rules were the result of a process which included 12 meetings of the National Standards Board in 5 years, solicitation of advice from numerous sources, including private certification organizations. Because the process was so open, the rules themselves are now subject to some skepticism. Charge being that these three elements are not found in any current definition of organics and were never recommended at any of these public sessions you had. And I guess my question is, are the folk that are saying that, have they missed it? Are there places where you do find those elements in an existing organic certification, or was there testimony or advocacy that those be included, or did they just kind of come out of the blue somewhere in the USDA, which is what some are saying?
No, they didn't come out of the blue, as you said. Genetic engineering has been a very hot subject, as you can tell from reading the comments. We felt in developing the proposed rule that we did want to open it up to comments. We have received extensive public comment in developing the rule, but we felt that since the Act itself was silent on these issues, we wanted to gather the best information we could before we developed a final rule.
The comment period for the rule lasts until March 19. And again, the USDA says the easiest way to respond is via their website at www.ams.usda.gov/NOP. A lot is at stake for individual farmers, processors, private organizations that have their own certification programs, retailers that sell organics, and consumers who want to buy pure food. If the standards are too low, people producing to a higher standard say they'll be hurt, particularly if they cannot say so on the main label on the product, something which is prohibited in the proposed rules. If the standards are unreasonable or too high, food which is organic in most respects will not be able to carry the organic label. If the rules about labeling product are not clear, consumers may be confused and unable to tell what is or is not included in the organic food they eat. USDA Deputy Administrator Stomas says we're talking about a growing market, which is measured in billions of dollars.
The organic market has been growing rapidly for the past several years. It's been growing at 20% per year. The last year for which we have numbers is 1996, and it reached $3.5 billion of total retail products. Now, one thing I would like to mention about that is it does not include meat and poultry products. So once the organic rule is in place, you may see an even greater expansion simply because meat and poultry will be added to that list. They are not currently allowed to be labeled as organic.
Next week, we'll hear from people who produce, sell, and certify organic food. And we'll hear them talk about how they want to see organic food labeled and how the proposed new federal rules could affect them. An international team of scientists recently traveled to Uganda to tally the number of mountain gorillas remaining in the wild. Researchers found the number of gorillas is climbing slowly in the African country, but the news is not as positive in the Virunga forest. Civil war in Rwanda is threatening gorilla populations in that fragile ecosystem. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
The census was conducted by the Bronx Zoo-based Wildlife Conservation Society, or WCS, as well as International Gorilla Conservation Program, the Institute of Tropical Forest Conservation, and the Uganda Wildlife Authority. The gorillas are found in Uganda's Bwindi Impenetrable Forest National Park. Andrew Plumtree, Assistant Director for the Africa Program of WCS, was among the scientists taking part in the count. He says the park is appropriately named.
To get there, you would have to take an aeroplane to Entebbe Airport in Uganda, and then it's about a 9-hour drive down to the nearest town. and you then take about another couple of hours to drive up a dirt track over volcanic lava to get to the forest itself. The forest is very mountainous, very steep slopes, and the vegetation that covers those slopes is very thick and dense, woody stuff that tends to bounce when you try and hack through it with a machete, so that it's actually very difficult to get through it.
Plumtree says it once took his team 9 hours to walk a mile and a half in the thick forest. In addition to the rough conditions, gorillas often move around, which makes counting them even more difficult. To improve accuracy, the researchers were divided into six teams with about five members per team. Each team was responsible for one sector of the forest. Working from east to west, the scientists covered the entire forest in about a seven-week period.
And we got a count of 280 known animals, and from looking at habituated groups, we know how many very small infants we missed from the counts. And so using a correction factor for that, we estimate there's about 292 gorillas in the whole forest. The last census in 94 showed that there were about 260 gorillas, and one done in 1990 showed there was about 280 gorillas. So it's slightly up on both of those counts.
But the news is not so good for mountain gorillas in the Virunga Forest. Though only 25 kilometers apart from their ancestors in the Buwindi Impenetrable National Forest Park, civil war in Rwanda is threatening the gorillas in the Virunga Forest. That's where Diane Fossey made many of her famous observations. The park borders Congo, Zaire, and Rwanda, with all three countries providing staff to protect the forest area and its residents. Even though a new government took over Rwanda in 1994, continued fighting has made it impossible to count the Virunga gorillas. Andrew Plumtree says the last count of the Virungas was in 1989.
The park staff have been finding it very difficult to go into the Virunga side, particularly on the Rwandan side of the park. There are people coming over from Zaire, Congo Zaire, and they're coming out of the forest and killing people regularly, and have been doing so most of this last year. And they're particularly targeting people who work for the government, which includes some of the park staff. So several of the park staff in Rwanda have actually been killed this year, and some of the park staff in Congo Zaire have also been killed. I think it's about six in Rwanda and about 10 in Congo.
The welfare of the Virunga gorillas depends on the park staff, not only because they protect the primates from poachers, but staff members also remove snares or traps that are the biggest threats to the animals. The violent conditions are taking a toll on many of the park staff. Plumtree recalls one of his friends in Rwanda telling him how militia members first tied him up, then tied his two-year-old son to his back. The man was then beaten, kicked, and threatened with machetes. He now sleeps outside each night, standing guard over his family.
Another example is a chap who he wasn't around when the militias visited him, and his parents were hacked to death by them with machetes, and his wife and his two kids were also macheted very badly and are still in hospital 2 months after that event.
Besides living in constant fear, the park staff is finding it difficult to live with no salaries. The government remains in turmoil and is unable to pay its workers. Furthermore, tourism dollars have all but dried up because of the violence. In hopes of keeping park staff members working, the International Gorilla Conservation Program raised some funds to pay the workers. But that money is now gone. Plumtree is hoping environmentalists and those interested in supporting the effort to protect the Virunga gorillas will contact him at the Bronx Zoo. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of a collector car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. The Environment Show always wants to hear from you. give us a call. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Or you can reach us by email, green@wamc.org. green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. The Safe Energy Communication Council in Washington says as householders, we could get the nation 45% of the way to meeting conservation goals that were agreed to in Kyoto. You can go on a basic CO2 diet by caulking and insulating your home, by replacing a 15-year-old refrigerator, which will cut energy use by 45% and save from $35 to $70 a year. Install a water-efficient showerhead and replace your old washing machine with a new energy-efficient one, which will also cut your electric bill by 6%. Weatherize your windows and wrap your hot water heater. Use compact fluorescent bulbs. Of course, if this sounds too easy, you might try a more radical approach and move into a windowless cave. We really don't recommend that. We continue our look at the year past and reflections about the future with members of the Environment Show Advisory Council. Douglas Kostel, former EPA administrator in the Carter administration and former dean of the Vermont Law School, is encouraged about what did happen at Kyoto and what did not happen in the United States Congress.
I think the big plus this year was getting an agreement in Japan on global warming. That was a real touch-and-go situation at Kyoto, and I think while this is far from solving the global warming problem, it's a major step in the right direction, and it commits, I think, a number of countries, including the United States, to taking it to the next stage, which will be to develop more specific implementation steps. That's a real positive. I think the other positive is, in a way, something that didn't happen, and that was that the steam for the moment seems to have gone out of the congressional efforts to gut most U.S. environmental statutes. And I think as we look forward to 98, that will be the thing to watch to see what happens in the Congress and whether we've really essentially stemmed the flood tide of damaging legislation.
What's your guess? Do you think we have?
Well, it's a little too soon to say. I think that this Congress is very determined to get reelected this coming fall, and I think they learned that the environment was an issue that could be used against them. And so I think they've kind of gone quiet a little bit, and I think that'll probably continue through the congressional elections. But depending on how those congressional elections go, this issue could come back again in the following spring, and then we'll see. There's still a tremendous ideological core group in the current Congress that would like to undo a lot of the environmental legislation that's now on the books.
Viewing matters from a state perspective, Advisor Langdon Marsh, Director of Environmental Quality for the State of Oregon, says there is a greater awareness about the role we all play as polluters.
I think one of the things we recognized more and more in 97 was the growing contribution to our total pollution load from the ordinary activities of citizens like you and me, driving our cars around, using hairsprays, painting our houses on hot days with high solvent paints, and running our lawnmowers with the most heavily polluting kinds of engines on them. And I think we've also recognized in some of the studies that have been done recently that the same is true with water pollution, that now in some of our streams, 50 to 100% of the pollution comes from runoff, from farms and forests, and ranches, backyards, and streets. Here in Oregon, for example, we have implemented a major salmon restoration plan, which relies heavily on farmers, ranchers, forest owners doing the right thing in terms of preventing further pollution of the streams and also cleaning up some of the legacy practices, old roads and destroyed riparian habitats, for example, that practices from the past have created.
Marsh also sees Western political leaders beginning to question the conventional wisdom that growth is always a good idea.
Oregon's gone through a major growth phase, particularly in high-tech industries over the past 10 years. And while that's been very good in terms of the economics of personal income and the general prosperity of the state, it has led to some problems with congestion, with the lack of affordability of homes in some areas, with some loss of farmland and forests, and even some increasing pressure on recreational opportunities like our state parks. And so I think there are some folks, even at the highest levels, who are questioning whether unrestrained growth is really a good thing. I would also note that somewhat surprisingly, the Western Governors Association got a conference together this past September where all of the Western governors, who are a relatively conservative group of people, got discussed what kinds of things could be done, mostly on a voluntary basis, to deal with growth management in their states.
That was Environment Show advisor Langdon Marsh, director of the Department of Environmental Quality of Oregon, reflecting on the environmental trends as we enter the new year. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, it's summer in the Southern Hemisphere, which means warmer temperatures and longer days. But the current El Niño is causing drought in Australia and Indonesia. Dr. Nan Bray is chief of the Marine Research Division with Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. A native of the United States, Dr. Bray speaks to us from Hobart, Tasmania, where she now works. It's a small island off the southeast corner of Australia. She says the dry weather is having severe impacts.
What we've seen in all through this region, through Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and all of Australia, is a lot higher incidence of forest fires and bushfires. And that's had a tremendous ecological impact, environmental impact. Both in terms of soot and smoke in over urban areas, you know, moving over urban areas, and in general in terms of losing biomass and you know, the destruction of large areas.
Dr. Bray says a lack of rain is not unusual during the summer months in Australia, but this year El Niño has prolonged the dry spell. Some fires are a result of human activity.
Particularly in the tropics in Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, there is, of course, a cultural history of burning off, which is discouraged, but I don't think is controlled. And I think that a part of what happened this year was that deliberately set fires simply got out of control over large areas of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. But it's definitely caused it actually caused Indonesia to declare something equivalent to a state of emergency for the country.
Dr. Bray says residents of Tasmania are being restricted to the amount of water they can use. She also adds that every time it clouds up, folks are crossing their fingers in hopes that it will rain. She believes the area has received less than half the normal amount of precipitation.
Part of what is important in the drought is the distribution of rainfall in time. And so one of the problems is that we simply haven't had any rainfall now for about a month and a half. So here, and also to a very great extent in the tropics in Indonesia, there isn't, because there's usually fairly steady regular rainfall, people don't set up irrigation systems to deal with this kind of condition. So the rice crop in Indonesia, for instance, I think has mostly failed this year.
Bray also says El Nino alters wind distribution, which in turn may be affecting nutrient levels in Australian waters. When El Nino ends, things should get back to normal. But to those of us who live in the U.S., summer in January still sounds odd. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we visit a plant designing fuel cells so you can generate your own electricity at home. The cells will be no larger than your washing machine, create no pollution, and may save you lots of money on your electric bill. The toughest restrictions ever on West Coast fishing have been put in place. Federal scientists say they're necessary to protect fish stocks. Fish processors say they go too far. We talk green about it. Volunteers on the Riverwatch Network connect schools with activists through citizen science and are cleaning up watersheds. Stay with us. Since its invention in the early 1800s, the fuel cell has not been considered a viable source of producing electricity. But like most things, time brought technological improvements, and by the 1960s, fuel cells were being used to power electronics on board NASA spacecraft. Until recently, the high cost of materials needed to manufacture fuel cells kept them from becoming a common item. But now, advances in fuel cell technology could revolutionize the way our homes are powered and help the environment. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
In 1980, it took $1,200 for 1 kilowatt of platinum to make a fuel cell. Today, that same amount of platinum is down to $5, which could make mass production of such cells a reality. Platinum is a major component in the protonics exchange membrane, or PEM, fuel cell, which differs from phosphoric acid and other cells currently being developed. Plug Power Incorporated is one of three companies in the U.S. and Canada developing PEM cells. Plug Power is a joint venture between Mechanical Technology Incorporated, located in Latham, New York, just outside of Albany, and Detroit Edison Corporation. Plug Power President Gary Middleman says the PEM cell works in three ways.
The first section, the reformer, turns natural gas into hydrogen. The only byproduct of this would be some carbon dioxide. So you get some greenhouse gas, but you actually get less than what you would get through a large generating power plant. The second piece, the fuel cell stack, turns the hydrogen into electricity. As a byproduct, we get some water and we get some heat.
Middleman says the third section is the power conditioning unit, which turns DC power into AC power, making the electricity more usable in the home. The cell will be about the size of a dishwasher and cost in the $3,000 range. A natural gas connection for the fuel source and a line going to the electrical box should make installation relatively easy for most homeowners, except those without natural gas lines in rural areas. The fuel cell will likely enable the average homeowner to remove him or herself from the power grid someday. While there will still be a natural gas bill, many homeowners will welcome the lack of a monthly or bi-monthly utility bill. Another benefit of the cell is the production of heat. Again, Gary Middleman.
When we produce electricity at a large coal-burning plant, we're also producing a lot of heat. And people there call it waste heat because it's shot up through the smokestack, stack we all know, into the atmosphere, or it goes into heating the local river or lake or waterway, and it basically gets wasted. When we have a fuel cell sitting in someone's home, it's generating electricity, but at the same time, the heat that's coming off of it can be captured, and it can be very easily used to preheat the water that goes into your hot water tank, which means that now you don't have to expend as much energy to heat the water up to the right temperature for your showers and dishwasher and so forth. Or it can also be used in the wintertime just to simply heat your house.
In addition, the cell has no power lines or moving parts, which could make power outages a thing of the past. The cell will be able to generate more than 2 kilowatts of electricity an hour, enough to handle the average 1 kilowatt hour used in the home. What's more is that excess electricity will be stored in a sealed lead-acid battery, similar to a car battery. Like other companies, Plug Power also plans on developing fuel cells for automobiles in the ongoing effort to help automakers reach zero emission status. But the benefits of this technology are not all financial. The environmental benefits could be tremendous since the cell will emit only a minimal amount of carbon dioxide and some water.
Combustion engines, or when you combust fuels at higher temperatures, you by definition are going to be getting some sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides mixed in there. These are the types of things that cause acid rain. With the low temperature electrochemical reaction that we're talking about in our PEM fuel cells, you don't get any significant levels of either sulfur dioxides or nitrous oxides.
Furthermore, unlike nuclear power, there is no spent fuel to dispose of. Gary Middleman says sometime in the future, homeowners will be able to go to Sears or Home Depot to get a new power source. He says it's an exciting time in the industry.
In fact, if we think about the PC computer and what it did to the mainframe computer, we think fuel cells are going to play the same role going forward compared to the large central station generating power plants that we have today. It's not that those large generating power plants are going to go away, but we're going to start to see these small fuel cells in house after house after house on a distributed generation basis.
Plug Power plans to have demonstration units operating by this June, with full-scale units running by October. He believes consumers will likely have to wait 2 to 3 years before residential fuel cells are ready for mass distribution. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about fish and the Pacific Coast, and specifically new regulations that went into effect on the first of the year, which are the most restrictive limits to be set ever on ground fish. Will these restrictions save fish stocks headed for commercial extinction, or will they extinguish the fishing industry? What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Two guests are with me. Dr. Richard Methot, he is a scientist in stock assessments with the National Marine Fisheries Service, and he joins us from Portland, Oregon. Also with us is Rod Moore. He's executive director of the West Coast Seafood Processors Association. This is an industry group which represents the folk who process onshore fish for market, and he's also in Portland. So, Dr. Methot, I'd like to start with you to begin with, since many of our listeners may not be sure. Let's start at the very beginning. What is a groundfish, and what kind of groundfish exist in the Pacific that are the subject to these regulations?
Well, thank you. The groundfish that we have in the Pacific along the West Coast really are a group of 83 species on the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. I suppose the most common thread among them is that they all at some time might be caught by trawls, although some are primarily caught by hook and line and others are important to recreational fishermen as well. Of these 83 species, we focus our efforts on looking at about 20 of them to determine their trends in abundance and what levels of sustainable harvest can be obtained from these stocks of fish. Again, some of these stocks are caught primarily with trawls along the coast, and there's a couple hundred trawl vessels that participate in that sort of a fishery, as well as a number of hook and line and other gears that target on other species within this complex.
Just for the consumer, what kind of fish, what variety that they would recognize, that a consumer would recognize in the market, fits within the groundfish category?
A large fraction of these fish are likely to be marketed fresh along the West Coast and in other markets, although Mr. Moore, I'm sure, will be able to give us more perspective on that as well. But many are marketed as red snapper of the various rockfish species, and flatfish also enter into the markets along the West Coast here. In addition, there's one species that over the last several years has grown into a substantial fishery that is processed into a surimi, which is a base product for fish analog products.
Now, the new regulations, which went into effect on the first of the year, do what, particularly as far as the fishermen are concerned?
The primary regulations are designed to control the total amount of fish that are removed each year. We target a constant fraction of the stock to be removed each year, which on the order of 10% of the fish might be targeted for a particular species. In order to control the catch to that percentage level, the regulations are set to put a limit on the total removals for all fishermen for the year. And in addition, additional limits are put in place for each vessel so that the total catch is spread out over the total year, so that there will be a fresh fish market throughout the year.
So, again, in layman's terms, what this says is that if I've got a fishing boat, I can only catch a certain amount. I can't go over that. And at the same time, you try to make sure that the whole species is only taken up to a certain amount. Is that the way it works?
That's certainly correct.
And the new regulations, though, cut this way down from where it was before. Is that the way it works, that you've got much lesser permitted levels of take?
That's true for some species. Not all species went into a further decline this year. And, assessments done in the past few years have noted some species staying at fairly constant levels. But, certainly new attention has been brought to bear on a few species that are showing additional signs of decline, and especially the level of concern over the certainty with which we are able to measure the magnitude of that decline.
So the reason that you're doing this, I presume, is because you fear that unless we restrict the take, the fisheries themselves will decline and ultimately there won't be enough fish left to be commercially viable. Rod Moore from the West Coast Seafood Processing Association, how do your members react to these new regulations?
Well, actually, it varies quite a bit, Peter. The fishing industry on the West Coast has been very supportive of science and good scientific management for years. In fact, for the last 20 years that our 200-mile limit's been in effect, we've been doing exactly what the scientists tell us. At issue here is disagreement over some of the data that goes into the stock assessments, some of the assumptions that are made in running the computer models that generate the stock assessments, and a couple of policy decisions that were made by the Pacific Council. There are several cases where we not only agree with Rick's team of scientists on what's going on in the water, but we support the reductions that they're talking about. There are other cases where we disagree. The effect, obviously, is going to be reduced harvest for fishermen, reduced fish for processing plants, perhaps higher prices for consumers. And if this trend continues for a couple of years, there's going to be some serious economic consequences for fishing families in communities on the West Coast.
Well, let me ask something that I think is on the top of everybody's mind who thought about this. If you look on the East Coast, you see fisheries that are almost non-existent because the restrictions that have just gone into effect were not put into effect years ago, and there was so much fishing pressure that they just about wiped out the fishery. Skeptics are going to say, when you argue that the existing regulations are too restrictive in some areas, you're going to take the world and the fishery into the same problem that was created on the East Coast. How do you reply to those folk?
Well, if I may, Peter, I'm quite familiar with the New England situation. And what happened in New England is that the scientists warned for years, based on a very good database and a long time series of data, that there were problems in the fishery. And unfortunately, nobody on the East Coast paid any attention to the scientists. You contrast that with this coast, where we have an extremely poor database. We have nowhere near the amount of scientific information that was available in New England, and we have a fishing industry that has gone along with what the scientists have said for 20 years. Our concern, or our amazement, is that here we've been doing everything the scientists told us to do, and suddenly we're told everything that we did was wrong, and that strikes a little bit of concern and uncertainty and frustration on the part of the fishing industry.
Well, let's leave out the question about whether people were right or wrong for a moment. Dr. Mathot, what I think I hear Rod Moore saying is that the existing new restrictions are not based on sound science. I'm sure you see that differently.
Well, certainly the efforts that we've made over the last many years to look at these species has been designed to take best advantage of what information we have available. And I certainly would agree with Mr. Moore that the quantity of information and the time frame over which you've collected this information pales in comparison to what's available in some other areas. And so, you know, from the beginning, we are not able to produce results that could possibly be expected to have the same level of certainty that you would have when you have more complete information. The new limits that are going into place are based upon new information that's becoming available. You know, our database is continuing to improve. And in addition, as we look forward, I certainly agree with Mr. Moore that we are with a high level of cooperation in discussing with the fishing industry how we can go about improving this database through cooperative efforts. And we're looking forward to improving the database into the future so that we can collectively achieve a higher degree of certainty with regard to the actual levels of catch that will be sustainable.
Let me ask you something, though. If the regulations are not implemented, we know that they are, what did you think, or do your people think, would be likely to happen? What is it that caused you to decide to move at this point?
The information that we had indicated that some stocks have declined substantially below the target levels of abundance that would be considered to be at a sustainable level. If we are to be certain that they do not decline substantially further than that, it's necessary to roll the level of harvest back to a level that is in concert with the level of abundance that's being projected. Again, we attempt to get a constant fraction of the population harvested each year, and if we do not roll the total catch back to be in line with that, there's plenty of potential that the stock could be pushed down to a lower level of abundance.
So, Rod, do you take the view that if you don't do anything, the stock would be okay, or do you take the view that you're just not certain enough about the numbers? In other words, is this a question of total disagreement, or is it a question of how much risk
It's certainly
assumed?
Not a question of total disagreement. As I said earlier, the industry supported and encouraged the scientists in some of the reductions that were made. On the other hand, there were some stock assessments, both this past year and the year before, that were highly controversial in terms of what data was being used,
and
how
just
it was
to
being
be
interpreted.
Specific, what kind of fish would be affected by the studies that you believe are currently causing too much restriction in the take?
Probably sablefish is the most controversial and the one that's been subject to the most dispute. Sablefish is not widely consumed in the U.S., by the way. It is primarily an export market. The stock assessment that was completed this year, and Rick can tell you far more about it than I can since he worked on it, was, again, fairly controversial in terms of some of the data that was included or not included, and this was not done by malice by Rick.
Right. In our diminishing time here, and I don't think anybody's talking about malice here, I think one of the questions, though, is can we afford to be wrong on this one? If you don't act based on the current set of numbers, is there likely to be so much damage to the fish stock that it will be hard to recover and ultimately cause your members a greater loss than what they may take with a restricted harvest now?
None of the recommendations that were made by the industry suggested going to such a high level that there was going to be long-term damage to the stock. Again, you get down to arguing over what the numbers are and what they say.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. Dr. Benthot, do you agree that the industry recommendations would not have caused permanent damage to the stock?
The level of harvest that we need for this long-term needs to be rolled back in order to be certain that it will be sustainable. In the short term, we do need to be cautious until we can obtain additional information to be certain that we are in a course that will be sustainable into the future.
And so what we now have is the restrictions in place, and I guess we wait for next year's numbers. Okay, I'm afraid our time is up. We've been discussing the new fishing restrictions in the Pacific, and we'd like to know what you think. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests have been Dr. Richard Methot from the National Marine Fisheries Service, and Rod Moore, who is from the West Coast Seafood Processors Association. We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. We'd like to hear from you. You can hear The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley, and Ear to the Ground is next.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Watching the River Flow with the Riverwatch Network. Bringing people together to monitor, restore, and protect the nation's rivers is what the Riverwatch Network is all about. Begun in 1987, Riverwatch Network education coordinator Sharon Bihar says their programs grow out of grassroots concerns for local rivers.
And we try to build networks between schools, between community groups, between businesses, and between all the different interests on a river to help them creatively solve whatever questions that they have in their area.
And they've done this, Bihar explains, by providing the necessary tools, like workshops, organizational and technical support, consultation, and publications. In this way, she explains, Riverwatch Network trains thousands of volunteers how to scientifically collect and analyze water samples from their local rivers and document their findings. With this vital information, Bihar says, local groups can assess their river's well-being, and Riverwatch Network will help them solve their river-related problems by contacting the proper regulatory agencies and so forth. Bihar says Riverwatch Network has helped over 70 communities work towards solving their river-related problems, including one in Hungary on the Danube River. Typically, she says, local Riverwatch programs begin with one or two interested people, and before you know it, the whole watershed is involved. That's just what happened with the Hudson Basin Riverwatch program. Like many of the Riverwatch programs, Hudson coordinator Doug Reed sought to connect schools with local environmental groups. In this way, he says, not only are the rivers getting monitored, but middle and high school students get hands-on science education. Reed began the Hudson program with only four schools. Today, over 20 schools sample river water from the Adirondack headwaters to tidal waters near Manhattan. And this, Reed says, is done four times a year.
Twice in the fall and twice in the spring. First 1 week and then the following week in October, early October, and again in early May. And we do this throughout the Hudson watershed at over 60 sites with 22 schools now, all aiming to sample on the same day so that we get a snapshot of the whole Hudson Basin.
Reed says the Riverwatch Network, based in Montpelier, Vermont, trains participating teachers with a complete course in the methods and theory of water quality monitoring.
They find out how to start it, go back to their schools with a new curriculum, and begin. The community partners are a locally based resource that it's up to the teachers and volunteers to coordinate.
One of the Hudson Basin River Watch groups worked on an erosion control project. Volunteers for the Mississippi Headwaters River Watch program identified two failing sewage systems, while participants in the Connecticut River Watch program found a substantial amount of phosphorus in a tributary, resulting in a treatment plant's improvements. Whether it's reducing existing river pollution, preventing pollution of pristine rivers, or gathering scientifically accurate information about river conditions, the Riverwatch Network is creating strategies for conserving rivers through community action. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't go ape-watching in Uganda, fishing in the Pacific, or find a drink of water in Australia without a copy of this show. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order tape number 420. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive director, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Stephen Whiteley is technical engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.